From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And if you look at the 7-day forecast right now for parts of Texas and Oklahoma, rain is in the forecast on 4, maybe even 5 of those days. Another flash flood watch is in effect, and flood warnings remain in effect in many counties across Texas. In Houston, officials say the San Jacinto River has risen to 52 feet. That's nearly 3 feet above its flood stage.
Officials in communities near rivers across the state are asking residents to evacuate their homes. Meanwhile, President Obama went to the National Hurricane Center this morning in Florida to receive the annual outlook for the hurricane season. The center predicts that the 2015 Atlantic season will produce fewer hurricanes than usual. Dr. James Elsner is a professor of geography and a hurricane expert at Florida State University. Professor Elsner, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So what does it mean to have a below normal season predicted when it comes to hurricanes? Does that mean that coastal communities can rest at least a bit easier this year?
No, not really. The forecast is for hurricanes that occur anywhere between Africa and the Caribbean. And so a below average season may mean we'll see fewer hurricanes out near Bermuda, but it doesn't mean we will see fewer hurricanes near the coast.
And does it mean anything about the severity, that if we see fewer in certain regions, then they may be less severe, or at least less severe by the time they get to the coast?
No, not really. The number of storms is somewhat unrelated to how strong they can get. So any particular storm that does happen to form can get quite intense.
So how does the forecast for this hurricane season compare with the past few?
Well, the past few seasons have not been very active. Last year, we only saw 6 hurricanes. And so we're kind of in a lull in activity. We saw quite a bit of activity in the Atlantic starting in about 1995. And of course, the 2004 and 2005 seasons were very active, especially here in Florida. But the last couple seasons haven't been so active.
What's dictating all of this?
Well, there are a lot of factors, especially on the seasonal time scale, but the most important is what's happening in the central and eastern Pacific, the El Nino phenomena. So when we see an El Nino like we are seeing this year, that tends to produce winds across the Atlantic that blow pretty strong, and these strong winds tend to shear apart any storm that's trying to form.
Can you remind us what El Nino is and what role it plays with hurricanes?
Yeah, well, the El Nino is a warming of the waters along the equatorial Pacific. So normally the waters are fairly cool off the coast of Peru. And that's due to the fact that the waters are coming up from below the surface in that part of the world. When we get an El Nino event, the water actually downwells, goes downward. And so the waters warm up all along the equator from Peru to the central Pacific. And what that does is tend to promote thunderstorms from over this part of the world. So we see more tropical cyclones over the eastern Pacific. And that, again, tends to produce winds that blow across the Atlantic in an unfavorable way for storms in this part of the world.
So with all the terribly severe destruction that we're seeing with storms and flooding in Texas and Oklahoma right now, to what extent are those related to El Nino?
Well, they are related to El Nino to some extent, yes. So what happens is we tend to get a river of air from the El Nino event in the eastern Pacific that moves across the southwest, including Arizona, New Mexico, and into Texas and Oklahoma. And that river of air is responsible in part for the heavy rains that we've seen across this part of the country. And that river of air is expected to continue through the hurricane season and over the Atlantic and make it less likely for storms to form.
There seems to be an increase in the number of wild weather events and stronger hurricanes. And there are some scientists who say there is a direct link between climate change and the stronger storms. There are others who say, yes, climate change is causing major extremes in the climate, but we can't tie any particular one storm to climate change. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think the fingerprint of climate change on storminess is starting to emerge. And that fingerprint is one of fewer events like fewer rainstorms, but when they do come, they're stronger. We're seeing that not only in the rainstorms, but also in things like hurricanes and possibly even tornadoes. So this is a fingerprint that the scientists are starting to see throughout the world. Fewer, but stronger.
All right. Thank you, Professor James Elsner of Florida State University. Good to speak with you.
You're welcome.
Well, British Prime Minister David Cameron is in Holland and France today, armed with a threat that the UK will vote to leave the European Union unless there are changes in the terms of its membership. The BBC's Rob Watson joins us from London with more. And Rob, Cameron is reflecting attitudes at home. What do the British people not like about being part of the EU?
Goodness, where does one begin? Well, I think we just have a very, very different attitude to Europe than the rest of the Europeans. And I know that as I'm married to a French person. I mean, I often hear from Europeans that it's a construct that really means something to the people of France, Germany, Italy. You know, it's a sort of profound mark of the end of hostilities on the continent. For us Brits, it's just a kind of practical, transactional thing. I mean, we think, right, and at that very British way of ours, if it's good for trade and if it keeps us all doing some sensible things, fair enough. Anything we don't like, we'd rather ditch.
But clearly a lot of people in the UK think that it's doing more harm than good, or the benefits are not outweighing the cons.
Well, here's the thing. In the long run, I think that Britain will vote to stay in the European Union. This has probably taken some of the excitement out of our interview, because I think that on balance, and again, I go back to that point that Europeans have a sort of a passion about Europe. We don't. We see it in a practical way. One suspects that after a great big, long, drawn-out debate, British people will think, well, you know, the risks of leaving, the risks of maybe some European companies not wanting to be based in Britain. Maybe it just sounds good to leave, to go on our own, but probably just a bit too risky.
All right. Well, let's talk about the changes that Cameron would like to make. What does he want to do exactly to the terms of the membership?
Well, I think the most controversial thing that he wants to do is to somehow make it that, yes, you still have free movement in the European Union. It's one of the absolute cornerstones. But that, let's say you were a young Eastern European working in Britain, you wouldn't get access to the same kind of social welfare that British citizens would have. Now, why does the British government want to do that? Well, if you've been in London recently, or anyone who's been here recently, if you go into any store that you like, you're almost certainly bound to be served by an Eastern European or a Central European. And an awful lot of Brits think that in the last few years, just too many people from Europe have come to live here and to work here. And the government, reacting to public pressure, is trying to make it less attractive so that there's less of a pull factor here in Britain. I think that's the most controversial thing. I mean, I think the kind of things which were a bit more window dressing are to say that Britain doesn't want to be part of any language saying that we're all heading towards some kind of United States of Europe. But I think it's the stuff around benefits, about freedom of movement, that's really going to go to the heart of this.
So how is Cameron going to make that argument in Poland? He's going to Poland tomorrow. We should say there are about 800,000 Polish people living in the UK, many in these service jobs you're talking about.
Well, with great care, I guess, is the answer to that, Jeremy, because, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a very sensitive issue in countries like Poland, where they have lots of their citizens working and living in the UK, and they don't want to be told, hang on a minute, a Polish person living in Britain is somehow worth less than a British person. So he's going to have to proceed with caution. But here's the deal. I think we're going to hear all sorts of stuff over the next 18 months or however long it's going to take between now and a referendum. But I think it's worth everyone bearing in mind two things, hold two thoughts in your head about what's going to determine this negotiation. Poland, all the other European Union countries, they would hate it if Britain was to leave the EU. I mean, how much of a vote of non-confidence would that be? So that's one part of the dynamic. On the other hand, all of these other EU members, they don't want to look too much as though they're awarding Britain for throwing its toys out the pram. So that's the dynamic. The European Union wants Britain very much to stay in, but obviously they're going to have to be careful about the way they do it and what concessions they offer.
Well, and we should say that these concerns about especially Eastern Europeans coming into the UK and taking a lot of jobs and getting welfare benefits and that sort of thing are not unique to the UK. This is something that a lot of Western European countries are dealing with in the new era of free movement by people in Europe.
Absolutely. It was bound to happen, wasn't it? I mean, it's what happens in the United States. If you have freedom of movement, people are going to move to where the jobs are, where the work is, where it's nice to live, where you can get on, feed your family. So the same thing has happened here. But of course, you know, Europe is not the United States, and it has created all sorts of tensions. And you're right, Britain isn't the only country that feels this way. I mean, I think there are plenty of people in Germany who are sympathetic to the idea of limiting welfare benefits. But again, bear in mind, you know, yes, everybody wants Britain to stay. Will it be easy offering the concessions? Well, the tricky thing is, you know, it's 28 members. So that's where the difficulty comes in.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, joining us from London as David Cameron makes a trip through Europe to try to get some changes made to the UK's membership in the European Union. Rob, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you can weigh in right now at our website, hereandnow.org. Now, this is not going to count towards anything, except we'll get some sense of what you think. Should the UK stay in the European Union, or would it be better off getting rid of that membership? Weigh in at hereandnow.org.
Our next story starts in the bullpen of the Portland Mavericks. Now, you may not remember them. They were an independent minor league baseball team that folded in 1977. The team was owned by the actor Bing Russell. He was famous for his role in the longtime TV series Bonanza. Two Mavericks players at the time, Rob Nelson and Jim Boughton, were not big fans of what most of their team members loved to do, chew tobacco and spit it, too. Nelson had an idea. Reporter Anna McDonald has written about that idea and the result for FoxSports.com. We've asked Anna and Rob Nelson to tell us about what's come to be known as Big League Chew. Now, Rob, I know that you have told this story a gazillion times, but again, please tell us about the moment when you had the big idea.
The story never gets old. It was the right field bullpen at what used to be called Civic Stadium here in Portland, Oregon. And you have a lot of free time out in the bullpen, just shooting the breeze and enjoying the evening with your teammates. And an idea came to me after I observed teammates who were spitting and chewing the other stuff, we call it. And I was never a big fan of chewing tobacco. And I turned to teammate Jim Boughton and asked him if he ever chewed it. And he and I had the same experience. We tried it once and thought it was kind of disgusting and really didn't make much sense. And an inning or so later, I said, for some time I've had an idea to shred bubble gum so we could blow great bubbles and not make ourselves ill, but we'd still look cool. And Jim Boughton loved the idea. He said, Rob, I think I could sell that idea. And Jim had a lot of business background, so it was the perfect convergence of somebody with a philosophy degree and somebody with a big business background, and things happened.
Things happened, and thus was the birth of Big League Chew. How many years ago was that?
Well, that was the summer of 1977.
Summer of 77, and how many pouches of Big League Chew have been sold since then?
Oh, I think at last count, over 700 million. I mean, it's a preposterous number.
Yeah, and who's counting? You are.
Exactly.
Yes, and why wouldn't you be? So, Anna McDonald, you decided to write about this. What reason did you decide to focus on Big League Chew?
Yeah, so as a little girl playing softball growing up, the first thing we'd do after our softball game was we'd run over to the concession stand and buy a Big League Chew. You know, it's the shredded bubble gum in a pouch, and you could, you know, as a kid, you could take as much as you wanted or as little as you wanted. You could kind of fold the pouch up later and save some for, you know, when you're back at home. And every kid growing up loved Big League Chew. And so, you know, I had no idea of how this gum was invented. I mean, who would think of this idea? Who would come up with an idea for shredded bubble gum in a pouch? So that's kind of, I was always curious about it and had the opportunity to dig around and report and figure out where this fabulous idea came from.
Rob, how did you decide from that conversation that you had with Jim in the bullpen that this could become an actual product? What did you do to even raise the money?
Well, you know, Jim Boughton used to say that, you know, I had the inspiration and he was the perspiration, and he's absolutely right. Jim put up the money for me to make some prototypes. As luck would have it, when I was with the Portland Mavericks, I didn't make the team in the beginning, but I created the Little Mavericks Baseball School. And one of the ball players there was the son of a prominent patent and trademark attorney. As it turned out, we'd gone to the same university about a decade apart. But Dan Chernoff and I really hit it off. And he did all the legal work for us, and Jim Bouton put up the money, and we made some prototypes, and Jim went out pounding the pavement. Took him 2 years to find a company to agree that this wacky idea might have legs, and that was over 3 decades ago.
3 decades ago, and what did the first incarnations of Big League Chew look like and taste like?
Well, the flavor was fantastic, and the chemists will tell you there's something about the ratio of the shreds and the softness that kids absolutely love. And as Anna said, the fact that you could stuff as much as you wanted into your mouth was always a fun factor. Plus, it allowed you to share with your friends without dealing with a lot of wrappers. The flavor was great. The packaging was awesome. There was an artist, Bill Mayer out of Atlanta, Georgia, who created the Mad Magazine type look of the Big League Chew characters. When Jim first saw them, he said, "Rob, these look like our Portland Maverick teammates. These guys do not look like baseball players." And we thought, well, that's perfect.
And why, by the way, did you decide on shredded gum? What's the shredding all about?
Well, the shredded just seemed to work in that same kind of package as what used to be the leafy tobacco look. It just made sense to me that you didn't have to deal with individual pieces of paper, which were all over dugouts and bullpens in America. The fact that you could just grab a handful and stuff it in your mouth, it looked more like a bowl of pasta than anything else. And it was just kind of dumb luck that when you started chomping on that, it allowed you to put a little bit more, such that, you know, in some games I'd get to about the fifth inning, I could blow bubbles the size of a soccer ball. And I wasn't alone in doing that.
Did you ever think, since you're making something that's going to be an alternative to macho chewing tobacco, as disgusting as it might be, did you ever think that pink should not be the way to express your own machismo in terms of the color of the gum?
Well, it's interesting you could say that, because I went to the Fred Meyer grocery store across from the ballpark here in Portland and picked up some root beer extract and some maple extract, because that was exactly my thinking back in the 70s. I wanted it to have that really rough and tumble look, but it was disgusting. It just didn't work. And the Wrigley people said, "Rob, you're the idea guy. We know how to make gum. And pink is the way to go." And they were absolutely right. Although I will say this, my preference is the purple. I love grape Big League Chew. That's my number one.
I wonder, Anna, in your reporting on this, can you make a distinction between players who chew chewing tobacco and players who chew Big League Chew?
I talked to some ex-Major League Baseball players, and the thing that they said was the Big League Chew kept them as kids away from chewing tobacco. So what I kept hearing was, you know, girlfriends or somebody would send them a box of bubble gum and say, "Just chew gum instead of chewing tobacco." And, you know, in baseball, there's just a lot of time to stand around. And so Big League Chew as kids, when they were on the Little League field, was just the perfect substitute to keep them away from chewing tobacco.
But can you draw a profile of the kind of player who would choose gum over tobacco, chewing tobacco?
Well, I can answer that. I mean, I know that tobacco in a pouch sales have dropped by over 2/3 since Big League Chew came out there. You just don't see the old Lenny Dykstra image in the 80s of a guy just dribbling with that disgusting stuff. The ball players are too smart to do that. So it's the younger players that are chewing the bubble gum. One of my biggest fans is Clint Hurdle, who is the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and he absolutely loves Big League Chew, and his players come into the skipper's office and pilfer his Big League Chew all the time. Last spring training, when I went down to meet Buster Posey, he is the catcher for the San Francisco Giants, and he has been, I guess, unofficially declared the face of baseball. And I think the whole idea of just having something to do, to chew and to blow bubbles, is a lot cooler thing for players today. One, because it's fun, and two, it doesn't have a deleterious effect on your health. Now, ball players today, if they get an extra 2 or 3 years in the big leagues, we're talking tens of millions of dollars. And players are not dumb. They know the bottom line is you want to be healthy, you want to be able to go out and play your A game. Now, I'm not saying that bubblegum is health food, but I am saying it's a fun thing for guys to do that's not going to give the health issues that in the olden days chewing tobacco would do.
Anna, in your story, you make an interesting relationship between the birth of Big League Chew and the place where it all started, and that's basically with the Portland Mavericks, when Jim and Rob were both playing for the Mavericks. What's the tie?
the tie is that it didn't seem like Big League Chew would have been possible without Bing Russell's influence in their life.
Bing Russell created the Portland Mavericks. This, by the way, the actor Kurt Russell's father.
Can I say something about Bing Russell?
Sure.
You know, Bing was a character actor. He was the deputy sheriff on Bonanza. He was a hugely talented guy. He was a Dartmouth graduate. He was just saw the world differently than anybody else. And the last year of the Mavericks, I was involved with the tryouts, and Bing said, we've got 300 guys out there. We want to give them the opportunity to find out that they can't play baseball so they can get on with their life. And if baseball is that vehicle, that would be great. But he just had this attitude that everybody should just be given every opportunity to find out what was possible. And when I didn't make the team and told him I had an idea for a baseball day camp, within 10 days, we had the Little Maverick Baseball School. He would grab ideas that made sense because he was as much involved and as much interested in ball players who love the game of baseball, who could play the game of baseball. And that enthusiasm was infectious. Whether you were a 14-year-old Todd Field, the bat boy, or me, 28 years old, 27 years old, just trying to hang on to play single-A baseball. Bing Russell just, he evaluated people on their merit. And absolutely love that guy. And Anna's 100% correct. There would be no Big League Chew without Bing Russell.
Do you guys both still chew Big League Chew?
Oh, I chew it all the time. I have 11-year-old twins and a 15-year-old daughter, and I can still kick their butt when we get into a competition.
It's nice to talk to you both. Thank you. Anna McDonald, Major League Baseball reporter in St. Louis. Her story about the origins of Big League Chew can be found on our website, hereandnow.org. And Rob Nelson, who played on the Portland Mavericks from 1975 to 77. He is the co-creator of Big League Chew with fellow team member Jim Bouton. Great to talk to you both. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Shanghai Composite Index of stocks fell more than 6%, the worst sell-off in months, and a big turnaround from Monday when stocks in China hit historic highs. James Arete is Shanghai correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And James, I want to ask you about why the market crashed today, but let's start with why it was at record highs in the first place.
You have a situation where bad news has been good news. The economy of China is slowing quite a bit, and there's a widespread expectation that the government will do things to pump money into the economy, and that this money maybe will find its way into the stock market, which seems to have been happening. And there don't seem to be a lot of other investment opportunities for people who, even though the economy is slowing, continue to get more and more money.
Now, when you say there aren't many investment opportunities, we have been hearing in recent years that Chinese people have been just pumping their money into real estate, even real estate that they aren't using. Is that not happening anymore?
The real estate investment trend has slowed quite a bit. People have about as many apartments as they need. Hmm. The feeling is that people don't want to be putting more and more money into the property market.
And what about out on the streets? Do you see signs that this is a record economy, or as you say, is this bad news, is good news, that things really aren't that great for ordinary Chinese people?
Well, you do feel that it's not the go-go years of just a few years ago where people are throwing money around willy-nilly. We don't see lines at banks the way we would have seen a few years ago in terms of trying to get a hold of this bull market. But what you do see is everyone on their mobile phones trading stocks. And it is getting more and more obvious that the market is more of a part of people's lives here.
Okay, which brings us to today and a big drop, the biggest single-day drop on the Shanghai Composite since January. What happened?
Well, it seems that the market had some stage fright. It was down 6.5% here in Shanghai, and that's the leading index. There are a number of reasons, but one of the big ones seems to be the way people have borrowed money to put it into the market, and some of the people who are lending money, the brokerages, are calling some of that in. But I think many people have been waiting for some kind of pullback in the market. And it's not clear that it's not going to bounce back. I mean, this is it's a big drop, but the market's still up more than 40% just this year.
But there are concerns, and I guess this is one of the reasons why people in the U.S. care about this, that this could be a bubble that would reverberate across the world if it were to pop.
Yeah, I mean, you have to care about the Chinese economy. It's the second biggest economy in the world. It's clearly slowing. And the stock market if it's something that they can get to work correctly, it would really be quite an amazing thing, and it could really help the economy of China. If it does go bust, there could be, it would just be another bad sign about the Chinese economy, and that's why it affects the world economy. It's not as if everybody is looking at the Shanghai Composite Index in the same way that they would be the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but they do have to look at it as an indicator of, you know, what else is going wrong with the Chinese economy.
That's James Arete, Shanghai correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. James, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for speaking with me.
This is Here and Now, and it is almost June, which means we are about to be deep in Supreme Court decision season, the end of the Supreme Court term, when the normally stately pace of opinions handed down by the court turns into something of an avalanche. Joining us now to talk about what's in store for us is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And how many cases are still in the pipeline?
Well, as of today, there are 25 for the court to big league chew on.
25, and they're going to do all those in a month.
Well, you don't know the half of it. For those of us who cover the court, I think of June as waiting for Godot. Hmm. There are actually only 4 more scheduled opinion days for those 25 cases. Now, the court will probably add a couple of more days to spread that out a bit. But this is the time of year when I get truly hysterical. Take this past Monday, we had 3 decisions, and the previous Monday, we had 6 decisions. And there wasn't a decent news story for the lay public in any of them. Mm. They were all what we inartfully call dogs. So we in the press corps show up for every opinion day full of hope, and every time we get dogs, we know that as the term draws to a close, there'll be a train wreck of opinions, and there simply won't be enough airtime or print space at the end of the term to cover all of those opinions.
So while your hysteria level is building with all these dogs, what is going on behind the scenes with the justices?
Well, the justices are probably hysterical, too. All the cases have been argued. All the writing assignments have been made at the end of each argument session. And by next Monday, all the justices are supposed to have circulated all their majority opinions to their colleagues.
What do you mean by circulated?
So each justice has a certain number of majority opinions that he or she has been assigned. And once a justice is satisfied with what he or she has written, and that can take some time, then the opinion is circulated to the other members of the court to join or dissent from. But and in addition to, most importantly, work on. So let's say the Chief Justice circulates his opinion in, I'll make this up, Smith versus Jones.
Yeah.
And one of the other justices may say, he'll write to the chief and he'll say, I'd be happy to join the opinion if you strengthen the paragraph at the top of page 18. And another justice might say, I'd be happy to join if you weaken that paragraph. And if it's a 5-4 decision, that all has to be somehow worked out. So drafts can make the rounds 5, 10, 15, even 20 times before the final product is ready to be announced to the public. And sometimes in that process, the outcome can change, or there's no majority for a single line of reasoning. It's a very rigorous and sometimes difficult intellectual process, all focused on words.
It's kind of surprising to hear that, because you sort of think of these justices as very stuck to their guns on their opinions on these things. The idea that they could have their opinion changed just by changing a few words is sort of surprising. But let's talk about some of the cases that we're waiting for this term. What are we waiting for?
Well, there are what I refer to as A-plus cases. In this term, there's same-sex marriage, Obamacare Round 2, and lethal injections for the death penalty. Same-sex marriage basically poses 2 questions. Is there a constitutional right to marry for same-sex couples? And if there is not, do the states where gay marriage is not legal have to nonetheless recognize same-sex unions performed legally in other states?
And in the Obamacare case, this is the second major challenge to the president's health care law. What is the difference between this time and last time?
Well, 2 years ago, the court upheld the law as constitutional. This time, opponents contend that the text of the statute does not authorize subsidies for people buying insurance on health exchanges in 34 states. Those 34 are mainly Republican-run, and they've refused to set up these exchanges. So the federal government has stepped in to do the job, which the federal government says it has the clear authority to do under the scheme, the conception of the act. Now, if the Supreme Court ultimately agrees with the challengers to the law and says to the federal government, you don't have authority to come in and set up these exchanges, it will mean that more than 9 million people will lose health insurance that's been made affordable through government tax credits and subsidies. And it will put health care once again, I suspect, front and center in the 2016 presidential election. Mm.
And you mentioned lethal injections as a major case. And I'm wondering, why would that be? The Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld the death penalty as constitutional.
And it's also upheld lethal injection as a method that's not unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. But the lethal cocktail used in the past is basically not available anymore. To be precise, the makers of the drugs used to put the prisoner into a deep coma-like state. The manufacturers of those kinds of drugs have increasingly refused to sell their drugs to be used in executions. So states have begun using another drug called midazolam, which is a sedative not approved as a drug capable of putting an individual into a deep coma-like state. And there have been botched executions, and capital punishment opponents contend that without a real anesthetic to dull the pain of the other drugs in the cocktail, the inmate suffers a cruel and nightmarish death. And what interests me so much about this case is that the oral argument turned into something of a guerrilla war between the court's liberals and conservatives, to the point that some of the justices themselves privately were horrified by the tense and nasty exchanges on the bench. Hmm. So there's a good deal going on there that you can partially see. It's like sort of an underwater volcano, and you can see the beginnings of it, but you're not sure what totally is going on beneath the surface.
Some of the A-plus cases that we are waiting for as the Supreme Court term comes to a close in the big month of June, and the dogs go away. And what do you call the A-plus cases, Nina? Do you have a name for them?
Just A-plus.
Just A-plus. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as the Supreme Court term comes to a close, it's also the end of the school year, which means many high school graduates are looking ahead now to college. Barbara Olachea is one of them. She's the daughter of Mexican immigrants and just graduated from Alhambra High School in Phoenix. Her story comes to us from Here and Now contributor KJZZ's Spot 127 Youth Media Center.
My name is Barbara Olachea. I am 18 years old, and I live in Phoenix. First and foremost, I am Latina, born in Mexicali, Baja California. My parents brought me to the U.S. when I was 5, so I could have a better life than they did. I am a dreamer. America is where I grew up, where I developed my identity. I haven't returned to Mexico since I came here, but as my parents often remind me, it's crucial to stay in touch with my roots. Freshman year in high school, a mentor who helped me estimate how much scholarship money I might be able to get for college asked, "Are you a United States resident?" I shook my head, expecting that look of sympathy I usually get. Instead, she pulled out a list of resources for children of immigrants. "You're going to have to try harder than everybody else," she told me. Those words confirmed what I had known all along. I was only starting high school, but I began to dread what most students anticipate with excitement: graduation day. What if I got into my dream school but couldn't afford it? That's what happened to my sister 6 years ago. Accepted to Arizona State University, but with almost no scholarship money. There were plenty of good schools outside of Arizona, but they were too expensive. Then I realized that some might offer me funding. I had good grades, but worried that I still wasn't good enough, that I wouldn't measure up. Despite my doubts, I applied to a lengthy list of schools, all with low acceptance rates. Months passed and the decisions began rolling in. After the first few rejections, I figured if I hadn't been accepted to one Ivy League school, I hadn't gotten into any. But then, I received an email from the man who had interviewed me for Dartmouth. To my disbelief, the word "congratulations" stood out on the computer screen. I have been accepted to Dartmouth College on a full scholarship. The daughter of immigrants from Mexico, a mom and dad who worked, saved, and taught me well. The daughter of Mexico and of America, shaped into who I am by my hardships and blessed by my opportunities. I wouldn't have it any other way.
High school senior Barbara Olachea. Her story comes to us from Here and Now contributor KJZZ's Spot 127 Youth Media Center in Phoenix. You're listening to Here and Now.
This week marks the unofficial start of summer, and that means summertime TV. But the television season isn't what it used to be over the summertime. Gone are the days with the old stale summer reruns and throwaway shows. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic, and Eric, it sounds like the TV execs are taking summer seriously. What are they doing?
They really have been taking the summer more seriously for several years now, partially because cable was able to show that there's a huge audience that's freed up once the networks go out of their regular season, and they took advantage of that. And then the networks realized they had to offer their own programming to counter the fact that cable would step up during summer. So we're really getting to the point where we have a year-round slate of programming, new shows coming on the networks and on cable that are really quite interesting and could air at any time.
Okay, let's start with NBC's Aquarius. This, in fact, debuts tonight, has David Duchovny in the lead. He's playing a cop in the 1970s looking for Charles Manson, the mass murderer. Is this a standard drama?
No, it's not. It's a period piece, obviously, and it's a piece where we sort of know the outcome, right? I mean, we know what happened to Charles Manson. We know what he did.
Still behind bars.
But this is also a show that's about the dark side of the 60s, and it's a way to sort of re-examine sort of the dark side of the flower child phenomenon, the dark side of hippiedom, and how police officers had to learn new tactics of dealing with people and new ways to recognize people's rights as they became a modern police force. And I think we even have a clip that relates to that.
Yeah, let's go to that now.
Got to read his rights.
What?
That new, that Miranda thing.
Miranda? Who?
Hey, you gotta do it.
You, dirtbag, have the right to a button you don't deserve, or I'll kick your teeth in. How's that? Is that?
Seriously?
I can't remember it exactly.
You know it?
Do you?
We even know it, Eric. They don't.
Exactly. So David Duchovny is playing this very sort of straight-laced older cop who just wants to sort of kick people's butts. And he has to team with a younger cop who's used to going undercover and pretending to be part of the flower child generation. And in between their two techniques, we wind up with an effort to find Charles Manson as he's recruiting people for his cult. So it's a pretty interesting show.
Eric, another summertime staple has become the reality series, and there are a couple of new feel-good reality shows premiering, one of them called Knock Knock, where unsuspecting people will get a knock on the door and a chance to win a cash prize, assuming they answer the door in the first place, I guess. But there's a favorite of yours as well that's returning, and this is Lifetime's Hoarders. I understand they're introducing a new live element to the show, which should be an interesting twist. Tell us about it.
Exactly. Hoarders is an unscripted show that aired for a while and went away, and now Lifetime is bringing it back. And they've added an element where they're going to have the families of people who hoard come to them and try to convince them to get professional help. And what I've always liked about Hoarders is that it's a show that talks about how hoarding can be the symptom of larger mental issues. And they bring in qualified people to talk with the folks and help them to see the mental issues that may have led to what they're doing in the hoarding. Now we have this element where the family members come in and we see the pain that the hoarding has caused the family. And if it's handled right and it's not too exploitive, I think it can be a great way of rebooting the show and adding to its compelling qualities.
So you mean it's an actual family intervention?
Exactly. They'll bring in family members to talk to the person about what they've been doing and urge them to seek professional help.
So, Eric, we always hear about big summertime blockbusters in the theaters, but how about movies on the small screen?
Well, yeah, so HBO has a great movie called Nightingale, starring David Oyelowo, who we saw in Selma playing Martin Luther King Jr. And in this movie, he's playing a military veteran who's struggling with serious mental issues. And what's amazing about this movie is that it's a one-man show. He is commanding the screen for the entire time, and you see his sort of slow descent into his own illness. And I think we have a clip of that as well.
That's right, mother. Smoking in the house. I'm sorry, it's not even 5 o'clock yet, mother. I'm breaking all the rules. Look, I'm not even dressed yet. And the police haven't come to arrest me. Turns out there's not a law that says you have to get up every morning at 7 o'clock and put on your clothes and your makeup and your costume jewelry. Whoever would have guessed that? It is my day off and I'm trying to relax.
So it would be no surprise to learn that his mother isn't actually there. But when you find out why she's not there and how that has contributed to his mental state, it even adds more drama to the movie. I would be incredibly surprised if he's not nominated for an Emmy for this performance.
Fascinating. Watching, sounds like, for the summertime. Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.